It's music from Joan Baez. I'm a poor wayfaring stranger. Mimi Farina helping her out with that. Randy Stonehill and Phil Kagi, That's the Way It Goes. We heard from them. We also heard from Terry Clark and Jesus Mighty Fortress. And it's about a quarter past, 13 and a half past the hour on this Monday morning. And we're joined now by Dr. Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Don.
And David's here, too. And today we kind of launch in a little different direction. We're in a couple of weeks going to be talking about the book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes. And it's a grand history, really, of not just the atomic bomb, but a lot of the different personalities and different scientific trends and philosophies that went into it and resulted in what turned out to be kind of a marriage between science and government in the 1940s. It's a fascinating history, and we'd recommend you read the book if you're so inclined. There's a link to it on our website now. There's a recommended reading tab on the homepage at brokenroadradio.com, and that links to the amazon.com page, but you also might just check with your library, see if you have it there. The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes. And David, your book hasn't arrived yet. Dr. Don, is yours?
Mine has not.
Okay, well, any day, and I got to find mine. It's been buried under multiple volumes here. But the history of science is interesting, and not so coincidentally, well, it probably is coincidence, but it was on this very date, in the year 721 BC, that the first recorded lunar eclipse happened. And it's the earliest recording of a lunar eclipse, and it was made known to us by Ptolemy in one of his publications based upon Babylonian sources. So way back in 721 BC, could be one of the earliest occasions of a scientific discovery, but wait a minute, I think there's something even older. We happen to be, Dr. Don, in possession of it's an audio recording, maybe the first digital recording of a scientific discovery, and it goes well back earlier than this discovery in 721 BC of a lunar eclipse. Now, I've got to tell you that the origins of this recording are somewhat murky. But I want to play it for you because it could be a clue to us of how science actually began. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's listen. This was found on a flash drive buried deep underneath the Temple Mount and came to us surreptitiously. Let's listen. Hey, Phineas. Heard about Adam and Eve? That couple over there in the garden, you know?
They still over there naming the flora and the fauna?
Nope, not no more they ain't. Got a little out of hand over there, I hear.
What happened?
Excitement. Real revolting development. Oh, look, Phineas, a little bit of light there on the eastern horizon. Say, Phineas, how long you figure we've been doing this together now?
Benjamin, for as long as I can remember. I wake up, make water, throw some bread into my pouch and climb this hill with you to ponder the deeper things of life, and we make the sun come up. Long time. Just look at all those stars.
Ah, stars, yeah, stars. Inspired name for them. That was a good choice, stars. Phineas, little something here I'd like to let you in on. Behold.
Zounds! Marks! Multitudes of them all over the cliff.
Yep, one for every single morning we've been here. Been putting them up all along. Now, this one stands for today. You'll notice something very different about this one.
You made a little V there at the top.
Well, today's a very special day among all days. You know why?
You invented graffiti.
Nah, not yet. Nope, today I am going to predict that the sun will come up right directly over the very top of that there mountain peak. Right exactly there.
You're kidding me. Now, how would you know that?
Well, I figured it out. Every so many days, the sun's right there, just like sundial work.
You can tell that from inscribing marks in the rocks. Looks to me, Ben, like you've made your mark in life.
Ah, Phineas, you might have just invented the cliche, I'm not sure. But you're right. This rock is a mess. It needs organizing. All these marks, I'm losing track here. Mark here, mark there, mark, 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 mark.
You just need a system of some kind. You could count them.
Why didn't I think of that? Well, just count them. Phineas, pray tell, how does one count?
Well, you give each mark an ordered name that you can remember, and then you put them in nice, even rows and columns.
You mean we gotta name all these marks?
It's the rational thing to do.
Might I interject something here? Here's a little problem. We ain't got enough names. It's not like we haven't got enough things to name around here already, and now all these marks, too? God help us!
Benjamin, simply name the marks the same way you count your fingers and toes. You know, digitize them.
Yeah. Like toes. It might work. Okay. Here goes. This little piggy went to market. This little piggy stayed home. This little piggy had roast beef. This little piggy... Hey, wait. I'm running out of things for these piggies to do. It's not going to work. Oh, look at that. How awesome is that?
Unbelievable. Came up right where you predicted. Benjamin, my friend, you've done a powerful thing there. No small matter this. What will we call it?
How about the dawn of knowledge? We'll call it knowledge. Strange feeling having all this knowledge. Kind of self-sufficient like, you know? Still something mysterious going on, though. Every year, same day, exact same place, sun will be right there. Almost like it was, well, kind of planned, you know? Like maybe it's made that way.
Brilliant. Nonsense! You're the one who did the marking and the ciphering. You did it! You said the sun would rise at that precise spot. You called it, and it happened. You'll be famous, Ben. Just think of what this means, what it's going to do for
calendar sales. Yeah, we'll call them calendars.
Yes.
You and me, Finn, we're going to make a fortune.
God, I like it. Calendars.
That sure beats herding sheep. Oh, look, a shooting star.
Oh, I thought we agreed on meteorite.
Come on, Finny, a shooting star has lots more pizzazz.
Ben, we need specificity here. Meteorite is specific and descriptive.
Yeah, but shooting star has more romance.
You want romance or accuracy?
I'll take romance. Oh, hey, I think there's a song you have. Ben and Phineas. Well, it's an ancient recording. Again, I can't vouch for the authenticity of it. It just came to us kind of out of the blue, and apparently a recording of the first scientist and the first skeptic at the same time.
And I think just because it sounds like people you might know, Don, doesn't necessarily mean that's the case.
That's true.
No. Right. I see. Yes.
Now, no knowledge of the earth.
I think I picked out the characters immediately.
Well, Ben and Phineas, they're a couple of knowledgeable ancients. We don't really know that they had scientific credentials, no PhDs back in those days, but they sure managed to figure things out. And one of the things that that Ben did there was to kind of relate mathematics to observation. And I'm wondering if whenever that actually happened, that might have marked the transition into an era of science of so. Dr. Don, what do you think? When did science begin?
Well, I think science has been here from the very beginning. If you look at what God told Adam to do right after he created him, or we don't know exactly the time frame, but let's assume it was relatively early after he was created, he told Adam to go and name all the animals. Now, God had another agenda, but this was the first indication that we have of really biology and syntax in actually naming the animals. So Adam kind of started the whole thing off by observing, and then observing the characteristics of the animals, and then giving them the name of the characteristic.
So then science at its most fundamental level is basically applying a matrix, an order of things, so that we can better understand it? Is that what science accomplishes for us?
Well, it's trying to figure out the world around us. And the video is either lagging completely behind or...
No, that's okay. I was transfixed there. I'm actually moving around here.
All right. So, yeah, I think trying to put some order into the world around us that we see, trying to figure out the world, I think that's been a fascination of man, like I said, from the very beginning. And I guess the real question, when did mathematics, start so that we could start putting some numbers to the things that we were observing? And as you said, the ancient recording kind of indicated, that putting mathematics to things so that we can predict what's going to happen.
You know, in my mind, mathematics itself was one of the big things that first got me to consider God and the possibility that there was a creator out there, because it's just such an awesome thing and a powerful thing. But it pre-existed us. I mean, math was always there, was it not? It's something that was discovered, not invented by man. It's relationships.
Well, that's a good question. Was it discovered by man? Was it did God even communicate to man and give him some type of numbering system? I mean, we know by the time Noah comes along that God is talking about measurement. So man had to be using some form of measurement in order to construct things. We know that Noah, for example, after getting the dimensions of the ark, he doesn't ask God, well, how am I to build this? Hmm. He doesn't say, what are tools? What are, how am I going to make this? Mm-hmm. It's as if God is telling him something that he already knows the basics of, for example, pitch or what gopher wood was and what a dimension was.
There's another implication there, and that is that God gifted us with really an inquiring mind so that we would not only receive from him, but we could put it to work and grow that knowledge so that we could understand and build and change.
That's right. I mean, we were made in his image. I mean, that's after God made Adam and Eve, he said that we were made in his image. So part of his image is God's image is being creative. And if we go back to Adam, we know that God was naming, for example, the stars and the earth and the sea and that type of stuff. So then he gave that job over to man after he created man. So it was, it's very, very interesting how God transferred, if you will, some of the responsibility that God had over to man. And from that, we're able to make a little sense of the world that we're in.
And that's another facet of this whole thing called creation that intrigues me. And I forget about it sometimes, that God made us in his image. Therefore, we must have, at some level, parts of him in us that cause us to behave the way we do and think the way we do and, as you mentioned, create the way we do. When do you suppose, you mentioned Noah and the ark, but things like the wheel had been invented. That could have been an accident, though. I mean, you see something rolling and you make a few modifications and all of a sudden you have a tool of some kind or discovering tools. Are those scientific things or are those just kind of intuitive things? Is there a difference?
Well, I think they're inventions. I mean, I think certainly the ancient, the Egyptians used logs, for example, to move heavy stones. The logs would roll, and you can go from that to maybe building a chariot wheel after some time. Mm-hmm. So it's not man. I mean, man has that innate ability. God created in us the ability to not only observe but to create and go beyond what we observe, to create new things. And I think that's what God had intended us to do from the very beginning. And we just get ourselves in trouble because of sin, that we create things that can destroy our fellow man.
And I'm wondering if one of the earliest symptoms of that was our penchant for attributing special power to people with special knowledge. One of the things that struck me from history is that the people who could read the heavens and knew the stars became the priesthood, who oftentimes ran the government and made the laws, and even to the point of really commanding the pharaohs and the kings and the national leaders. People with special knowledge gain special power. Is that a corrupting thing?
Well, it can be corrupt. I mean, if you have in a fallen world, we have pride, and once we know something that somebody else doesn't know, you have a little power over them, and so that that becomes a very it could become a very corrupting aspect. And if for example, take Nimrod. he had power over other, some of the other nations because he was the first one to, that we know of at least, to use metal for making weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that ability, he was then able to conquer his neighbors around him, and he became a great warring nation.
Well, it's an amazing history with all kinds of loose strands. I'm just hoping we can weave a few of them together here and bring it forward to the modern era. There's still something called pure science and applied science. Can you define the difference between the two for us?
Well, I think applied science is easier to define in the form of all engineering is applied science. So if you want to build a bridge, you're using mathematics, you're using physics, and you're using you have an understanding of the material that you're working with, and you're saying, well, if I have an expanse of so long, it's going to take, let's say, a piece of concrete with reinforced steel in it this thick in order to bridge that gap. So that's an applied science. Pure science is you're pretty much starting from nothing, and you're observing and then trying to make guesses out of something that you've observed. In other words, you're kind of building the mathematics for the engineer, mm-hmm. if you will, and so it's a precursor to the applied science. And applied science usually lags quite a bit. There's quite a bit of time between being able to discover something in pure science and then being able to apply it and build something out of it or use the technology.
Is technology shortening that time? Has it changed in the last century, say, the time from...
Very much so. So let's... When I was going to school and when I was getting my PhD in biochemistry, for example, the enzymes that are used, that have been used to even code, do the genome project and decipher the DNA of the human genome, the restriction enzymes, and that was made possible, recombinant DNA and all this other stuff, that was just being discovered. And after that discovery, then we had recombinant DNA, we had genetic modification of plants and animals and cells, and then from there, that led all the tools that were developed in order to analyze what you had, then we were able to apply to figuring out what our genome was, what our DNA sequence of the human cell was. So that was in a very short period of time.
And that brings to mind another question. At what point do moral considerations become part of the equation? Because we've taken that knowledge and done some things in applied science that maybe we ought not to be. And there's divided opinion on it because somehow a morality has been injected into this. Some things are moral to do with these discoveries, some things not. Kind of a marriage of philosophy and science, is it? Or religion is certainly a part of it.
Right. Your value system has a lot to do with how far you go in your applied science. And, stem cell research, whether you're using embryonic stem cell generate the genetic material that you're then going to, the stem cells that you're going to use to make various human parts with, that's been a very large controversy, obviously, not only in science, but in politics as well as in the religious circles.
And I'd like to add that in this book that we're going to be kind of going through here in a few weeks, that consideration plays a huge role with Niels Bohr and other scientists involved in the developing of the atom bomb in the 30s and into the 40s, and that's still with us today. I wonder how far back that moral dilemma goes in science. Was it a factor in the Age of Enlightenment when we were discovering some of these principles and putting gears and power together and making machines? Was it the same argument then? You know, did God mean for us?
I think it was. I mean, it's you take the case with the atomic bomb. I mean, you're building a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, it's not a one-on-one combat situation. So you've greatly magnified your ability to destroy your enemy. Well, with Nimrod, for example, with him being able to forge swords and things like that out of metal, that gave him, as I said before, a tremendous advantage, and he used it. You know, of course, that was more on a one-on-one type basis. Mm-hmm. It's like Cain started the problem by using a rock and hitting, you know, Abel. Mm-hmm. And it's that that moral corruption that we then use what is pure, what is just knowledge, and you know, use it to our advantage to try to subdue our fellow man. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the problem comes in.
And it's,
I mean, if we were human beings, you know, we could discover things and use them in a very useful way and not harm our fellow man, but we don't have that tendency.
Mm-hmm. And in reading about history, and I'm certainly no authority, but Islam made great leaps ahead in science for a period shortly after their founding. I'm thinking 6th, 7th, 8th century. With mathematics and art, I'm wondering if scientific development goes hand in hand with other cultural factors. In fact, David and I were talking earlier today, and he's brought it up a number of times about these eras in scientific progress that somehow there needs to be enough mass here to push opinion in a certain direction so that new discoveries can be made. That kind of results in eras where people start marshaling information and arguments for and against, and then sooner or later a new direction takes off. But Islam made some great leaps for us early on and then disintegrated because of internal warfare between, you know, they factionalized. Is Christianity a stronger moral grounds for scientific advancement? I mean, I'm thinking here East versus West, and this whole dilemma and dichotomy that's evolved over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have to have a number of things, you know, working for you. Obviously, if you're in war or have been devastated by war, you're not going to have the leisure time to sit around thinking about things, mm-hmm. or, you know, painting beautiful pictures or doing wonderful sculptures. You know, the Renaissance, for example, that was a time of peace. It wasn't a time of chaos. So we've got to get past the chaos so that we can have a time of peace, so that man now has time over and above just gathering his food, for example, mm-hmm. and to be able to think. And given freedom to think, now how are you going to use that time? I think is how science can progress. Now, another element that you really need is you have to believe that the world is ordered. If your philosophy is such that the world is in chaos and everything I see around me is in chaos, there's no point in doing one experiment, because if you have a guess or a hypothesis that says, if I do this, this will happen, there's no reason for you to believe that if you do it again, you're going to come out with the same answer. So you have to come from the point of view that the world is ordered.
And to me, that's what science does. It confirms for us that the world is ordered and should reflect back on the Creator. But we haven't always taken the news that way, have we?
Yes. I mean, it should very much point back to a Creator, because God created an ordered universe to begin with. And He plants a human being made in His image that can help bring order to the world around him, to help him understand this is the environment that I live in.
There's a lot of scientific debate about order versus chaos and what direction we're headed in. And there's something called string theory, which I don't even pretend to understand. Can you kind of summarize what that is?
It's basically saying that the subatomic particles are made up of vibrations, and actually goes along quite well with what I was saying a couple of programs ago, or maybe it was the last program as well, talking about the very voice of God.
Yes.
And that it's like having a vibrating rubber band, but circular, if you will, and that vibrating rubber band then is your string, and depending on the type of vibration, the frequency of the vibration determines what type of subatomic particle you might have. Mm-hmm. At least that's the a very gross explanation of what string theory is all about.
So it kind of explains away chaos, then. It's a way of explaining what is apparent chaos.
Well, but it's not. You see, vibration isn't chaos.
No. But I'm saying that the string theory then gives us a rationale, places a system of order on what some might call chaos. That is apparent random events.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So even down to the subatomic particle level, to the very essence of the physical universe, you can see order. So you go down from that level, go on up into the heavens, and the stars are, God says in His word that He placed them, in the sky, that they're in a certain position, for us. So we've got order all throughout the system, and no matter what you look at, there is order.
And it seems like sometimes we've got it backwards, because in that whole progression, and then the book deals with this a little bit, the notion of the existence of a basic building block, a basic unit of matter, goes back to the Greeks and the concept of an atom. And since that time, the thought has been things get simpler and simpler and simpler until you get to that simple building block called an atom. And yet, in this day and age, we're inside that atom and discovering that it's a whole lot more complex. And the deeper we go, the more complex it gets. In the other direction, I wonder, if it gets simpler, maybe we're the simplified creatures.
Yeah, I think. Well, there's nothing simple about us. I mean, that's because we are machines within a machine within a machine. I mean, it's just that we've got in the same thing. I mean, the deeper inside of us that you go, you look inside a cell, and what Darwin thought was just, oh, this is just simple protoplasm, just a bunch of goop, turns out to be chock full of little machines running around doing all kinds of things. So
as Del Tackett would call us in the Truth Project, Goo Man. That's what we were thought to be by some, and discoveries are rapidly turning that notion around. And again, that book deals with kind of some of these things, and we're looking forward to our time in the book and with you, Dr. Don, as we kind of go through the history of science and pick some turning points that we could maybe identify and use as a way to explain why we are where we are now in the whole creation versus science and religious versus or faith versus science dichotomy. So thank you so much for your input today. It's been a wonderful time. David, always give you the last question, because you think through this whole discussion and you always come up with something marvelously intricate and extend the program by 45 minutes. No, go ahead, David. No, I don't mean to discourage you, David. Not at all.
Okay. Go ahead. 45 minutes, you mean hold it down to that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if you would.
I think he's saying 45 seconds. You've got 45 seconds.
45 seconds. That sounds more like it. Yeah. And it's not really a question. It's more an observation. And, you know, in the conversations we've had in the past, particularly about evolution, that we're looking at, the whole process upside down, that we sit here and think, well, the guy that we called Etsy, who was discovered in the Alps 5,000, supposedly was died 5,000 years ago, was actually smarter than we are, and we've got this whole image of those kind of fumbling creatures have evolved into something wonderful like us. It's the same kind of upside down thinking that we think. Well, let's see. We must have discovered this this orderly system that was already put in place. I mean,
this is Dr. Dobbs' theory of devolution. That is what.
We've been wandering along saying, look at this wonderful thing we've created. This scientific process. This look, we can just out there and look. There's the same number of trees out there that I counted yesterday. That must mean something. But, you know, we didn't create those trees. We didn't put those trees there. We've just discovered them. And then in our human-centeredness have said, well, it must be us. But it's upside down. Mm. I mean, the system was already there. We've just discovered it. As opposed, we didn't create the system. Okay. Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's the same observation. But it just expanded, and I think my 45 seconds are up.
I think so. But you did wonders with it. And the thought occurs to me that in dealing with God and creation, and this is something maybe we can't really get our brains around, but we're dealing with infinity here, with the infinite, with the perfect. And we're not that way. We're a different animal than that. So when we try to presume to know what the infinite mind of God can do, all we succeed in doing is discovering more and more levels, more and more information, more and more new horizons, and more theories, more and more fields to conquer. Would you agree?
Well, I would certainly agree. I mean, that's the one of the fascinating things about science. You can, no matter how far you push the envelope, there's more envelope to push. And so, I want to bring it back to as we discover these things, as created beings and as children of God, we should be sitting back and saying, wow, look at what God has done. Isn't this awesome? God is just an awesome being. And that's where it should be taking us. Not to the opposite extremes and saying, oh, look what I can do as man. Look what I've discovered, unfortunately, which is the route that we've gone. And God is not pleased with that.
Well, I'll give you a great big amen to that, Dr. Dodd. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to end the talk today. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to next week.
I'm just wondering, you know, God realizes that Ben and Phineas are tongue-in-cheek characters, right?
Well, I think so.
At least I hope so.
I think he just took his fingers out of his ears is what he did. I think. Yeah. Be blessed today, good. Dr. Don. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good talking to you, Don. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim. I mean, Dave.